This is Eleanor Swint continuing an interview with Frank Jocklick in Salt Lake City, Utah on January 22nd, 1994.
The Chino concentrator came on stream at the end of October of 1982. And I remember shortly after that, Senator Pete Domenici, our friend Pete Domenici, coming to inspect the facility, and it was both a, it was a beautiful day, but there was a certain damper on the occasion because with copper price below 60 cents a pound, Kennecott was still losing money at a great rate. I think the loss for September was something like $17 million, and the forecast loss for the whole of 1983, for the following year, the forecast was a loss of close to $100 million. Well, that was a fine atmosphere in which to negotiate for funds to carry out the second stage of the modernization of Chino, which was essentially the rebuilding of the smelter. The partnership agreement with Mitsubishi provided that a new smelter with a capacity to treat 500,000 tons a year of concentrates would be built. The cost to be shared, two-thirds Kennecott and one-third Mitsubishi. Now, this phase of modernization would have started earlier had it not been for the need to negotiate an agreement with the state on environmental aspects of the project. At the time, operating with the old smelter, only 60% of the sulfur in the concentrates was being captured. The smelter was meeting the ambient air standards by curtailing production, but it wasn't meeting the emission regulations. The plant was operating with a dispensation from regulations under a non-ferrous smelter order. But now the time had come where the smelter had to meet the new SIP regulations of New Mexico, state implementation plan for SO2 and particulate emissions.
So you were given a time in which to comply.
Oh yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And that really finally triggered the go-ahead with the smelter project. We reviewed the potential technologies and quickly discarded the Noranda alternative in light of our experience at Utah Copper. Mitsubishi were pressing the case strongly for their technology, but we finally selected the Inco flash smelting system, in which sulfide particles are injected into the smelting vessels and burned in a stream of oxygen. The capital cost was estimated at $126 million. And in light of the fact that we could only... Well, I'll say it once more. Because
sorry.
The existing concentrator, at least because the existing smelter could only treat half to two-thirds of the output of the new concentrator, the smelter project could be justified both economically and environmentally. Economically, not in relation to prevailing copper prices, but in relation to the alternative continuing to incur the cost of shipping the excess concentrates to smelters elsewhere.
Was there any new factor other than the environmental regulations? Was it the same chemistry of ore and so on that you'd had before, or was there a change?
No. I mean, it's all Chino ore.
It was the same that you had had before. It was just a change in regulations.
Well, and the economics of the economic disadvantage of having to ship concentrates.
Mm-hmm. Did you retrieve anything that you could sell? Could you the sulfur?
Well, yeah. I mean,
you got acid?
The part of the new smelter project was a new double contact sulfuric acid plant, and
which you could
as with all acid plants, you're faced with the indestructibility of matter. You're going to convert sulfur into sulfuric acid, and then you've got to find a home for the sulfuric acid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question then of just how far you have to rail it or truck it to find a market for it. In the United States, the most important market for sulfuric acid is in the fertilizer plants in Florida and in the Midwest. That's the market of ultimate resource for a smelter in the western United States. So if you can't find an outlet for chemical or other uses closer to home, you just got to buy a lot of tank cars and get it out to those markets. And in times when the fertilizer industry is weak and the demand for sulfuric acid therefore declines, the shipping costs, rail costs, can be prohibitive, and you incur a negative netback on all the sulfuric acid that is produced. And there were periods at Chino and at Utah Copper when that situation prevailed, particularly, I believe, if I remember right, at that time. Every ton of sulfuric acid you produce cost you money.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you get paid for it. Two-thirds of $126 million was $84 million. Standard Oil had acquired ownership of Kennecott not long before, and this was their first request for major capital funds related to their newly acquired copper business. Considering the operating losses of the time, this was rubbing some salt in the wounds. Our first presentation to the Sohio board on the smelter in July of 1982 was a fairly stressful meeting, with the result that the request was turned down. We went back and regrouped and went back in September and this time we probably had our case better prepared, and project was reluctantly approved.
Had you negotiated this arrangement with Mitsubishi before?
Well, as I said, the construction of the smelter was part of the original agreement with Mitsubishi.
With the agreement that, okay, right.
The smelter, the principal contractor for the smelter project was Stearns Rogers out of Denver. They did a good job under the supervision of Raman Rao and his team. The project was completed on schedule, within budget, started up in October of 1984. And reached full production in the first quarter of 1985. We were then able to smelt all of the concentrates, produce the chino, and to meet the environmental regulations. That completed the modernization of chino. I think I've mentioned before that we had in mind to build an SXEW plant to replace the precipitation plant in which the copper from the leaching operations at chino was being recovered. We had design and cost estimate prepared, and had the forced sale to Phelps Dodge not taken place in 1986, that project would have been carried out by Kennecott. As it was, we handed over the operation with the gains in the labor negotiations of 1986 in place.
Did PD go ahead with that SXEW plant then? Or?
I believe in a modified form, yeah. The modernization of Ray mines was considered. The installation of the new leaching system for the silicate ore improved the economics of that operation beyond the cost reduction measures that were implemented there in the early 80s. But when it came to contemplating further expenditures on modernization of copper operations, it was clear that Utah Copper should have the priority because of the potentially larger gains. And this is what I'd like to talk about for a few minutes now. When I first looked at potential investments in Utah Copper in 1980, the first thing that struck me was how previous piecemeal attempts at modernizing the operation had not achieved the desired results. It was difficult to see how the Bonneville crushing and grinding plant to supply supplementary feed to the Magna and Arthur concentrates of early 20th century vintage could be expected to have a lasting beneficial effect. We put together a team to study a modernization plan that would address the whole ship from stem to stern, starting from the mine and going right through to refinery. And what we could see was that the mine, with the substitution of truck for rail haul completed, would be in reasonable shape, that if we could just see a way of shifting the concentrating operations close to the mine rather than having it at the end of a 19-mile rail haul, fragmented between three plants, Bonneville, Arthur, and Magna, we would have a major breakthrough. That the smelter, after the expenditures of the 70s, was limping along substantially in compliance with environmental regulations, but still beset with severe operating problems, and that the refinery of relatively more recent vintage, it was built in the early 1960s, had been reasonably well maintained.
What was, just for the record, the location of the smelter and the refinery?
They were west of the concentrators. I intend to put a sketch in here somewhere to show where these are. Otherwise, this is just too hard to follow.
These things come at different times and in different locations, and so they were scattered all over the place.
Yeah. Now, as I said before, the reason for the concentrators being that far from the mine was a question of water. The well field on the shore of the Great Salt Lake, pumping fresh water, I should say, emphasize, was the water supply for the concentrators. And determined their location early in the century, when pumping water over long distances had not been practiced that much in this country, as opposed to Australia, where a man named O'Connor had just or was in the process of building a 400-mile water pipeline from Perth on the coast to the Kalgoorlie goldfield, which were being developed at the time. He was a brilliant engineer, and he just made one error. And I may remember this incorrectly, but apparently when they started pumping water through this 400-mile pipeline, he calculated the time it would take for the water to reach Kalgoorlie. And he made a major miscalculation there. And when, after a period of time that he calculated was adequate, there was no water, he shot himself. And the water came within hours after he committed suicide.
Dear.
Anyway, that's an aside.
So 19 miles wasn't so much.
No. Popular wisdom was that there was no way a suitable site could be found for a concentrator close to the mine, partly for topographic reasons, but principally because it was not thought that the environmental approvals would be impossible to obtain. So we started talking to the state authorities, and lo and behold, certainly an array of permits had to be obtained, but we were assured that provided the plant was designed for zero discharge in that area, there was no insuperable obstacle to locating a plant. Near the mine. And we went to work with a conceptual design and picked a site which was partly on Kennecott land, and in as early as February of 1982, we went to the Sohio board with a request for, I believe it was about $20 million, to acquire the necessary land for the location of a new concentrator. And this was approved, and over the next couple of years, we gradually acquired this land.
This was it.
That was a necessary stand. Yeah, this is at the concentrator location, which is about 3 miles north of Copperton, on a on land which slopes gently to the east, along the foothills of the Oka Range, and from the point of view of process flow, is an ideal site.
So the obstacles were funding environment?
Well, I mean, as I just said, the environmental obstacles we found could be overcome.
Mm-hmm.
Our next step was to think about an optimum throughput rate. In other words, the optimum rate of production out of the pit to be matched to equipment types and sizes that would best handle that rate of production. We came up with something like 80 different alternatives,
mm-hmm.
In which the principal variables were the cutoff grade, for the pit, and I'm talking about the cutoff grade that will determine the ultimate pit limits, as well as the operating cutoff grade within those, within the pit limits, and the rate of production. And the stripping ratio. Because Sohio felt that they had perhaps overpaid for Kennecott, considering the state of the depressed rate of copper markets, it was difficult to convince them that in discussing the ore reserves, we should be talking about perhaps higher grade and less tonnage, because the reports had the reports in the annual reports and so on talked about billions of tons, which which implied ore grades that just couldn't be economically treated with anything but a very optimistic forecast of copper prices. So these, with these alternatives, we went through many iterations and numerous meetings and discussions with Standard Oil, and we generally found ourselves not in full agreement.
Was this partly because of the difference between oil and mining?
Well, I'd just given the reason why. It was the concern about being seen as having made
a
poor acquisition. But you're right. It was naturally very difficult for people who'd spent all their lives in the oil industry to quickly pick up the realities of the mining business, where you generally dealt with much longer time frames than one does in the development and exploitation of petroleum reservoirs.
Did you have any partisans on the board?
Oh, no, not not at that time, it wasn't even the board, but in Sohio at that time, exploration for oil in the lower 48 was being escalated to a much higher level than mm-hmm. had been the case, and we found the funds required for this escalated effort to be pretty breathtaking, and this is why a major investment in the modernization of Utah copper was not looked at favorably in mm-hmm. the early 80s, and we sometimes felt that some of the opposition to proceed absolute objections to the logic of going ahead with the modernization.
Just that you were lower on the pecking order?
Yeah, because we could demonstrate very clearly a reduction potential in operating costs
mm-hmm.
that would provide a handsome return on investment, provided one had made the basic assumption that Bingham Canyon would keep operating.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this basic philosophy or element of philosophy that had to be dealt with first, because there were certainly people on Sahaja's management who thought that Bingham Canyon would be better shut down and beyond that abandoned, with the abandonment costs and the reclamation taken at this time. These people were going around saying, you know, it's time to bite the bullet now rather than pouring good money after bad.
Right off a bad deal.
Yes. Yeah. This was a very real threat. And now, of course, today, with the benefit of hindsight, hard to understand, or at least hard to believe.
Mm-hmm.
But if one really considered what the environment was then, the very depressed copper prices, national economy that was just emerging from a recession, declining oil prices, and a quest for substantial funds for oil exploration by some members of Sohio management, then it's logical to believe that there was a substantial group there that was all in favor
mm-hmm.
of shutting down and abandoning Bingham Canyon. The design that we had come up with by 83 and certainly by 84 was for a concentrator throughput rate of 77,000 tons a day. in a pit envelope with a cutoff grade of 0.4% copper. Sorry, 0.45% copper. And of course the operating cutoff could be adjusted almost day to day as metal prices warranted. And we have at times since then operated with a cutoff grade as low as 0.25% copper. The estimate for this project was $572 million expressed in 1984 currency. The scope of this project was an in-pit crusher and conveyor system that would eliminate the double handling of ore by double handling, I mean the elimination of rail haul to the marshalling yards at Copperton and then what I really mean by that is truck and rail haulage within the pit to stockpiling areas, then withdrawal from those stockpiles to the rail haul out of the pit, and then marshalling the trains and the Copperton marshalling yards for the haul to the existing concentrators. That as opposed to in-pit crushing and a 5-mile conveyor directly from the in-pit crusher through the lowest tunnel in the canyon to the new concentrator site east of Copperton. A concentrator in which the hundreds of small crushers and flotation cells would be replaced by three 34-foot sag mills and six ball mills. And 3,000 cubic foot flotation cells, and a slurry pipeline from the look, I'm backtracking here. I have to correct that. I'm thinking a year ahead. You see, this cost estimate of $572,000,1984 or $680 million escalated dollars. We had tested the waters on that and found that we weren't going to be able to get that much money under any circumstances. And we had to play a little politics there, and after some sleuthing around Cleveland, we came to the conclusion that nothing over $400 million would fly, that we had to keep a project under $400 million. I know that's doing it the wrong way around, but those were the realities of the day. And the people in Cleveland who were looking over our shoulder at the project said that at most what we could hope for would be crushing and grinding facilities in primary crushers in the pit, conveyors to the new concentrator, and sag and ball mills in this new sort of crushing and grinding plant, and then slurrying the transporting the ground ore in the slurry pipeline to the
sweet pot we're getting now. Okay, now it's coming through just fine right now. Now we're okay. So the politics of the situation were that you needed to do it in increments? Or?
Well, unfortunately, this wasn't really going to be increments. This was regarded by Sohio as a long-term solution, mm-hmm. but certainly not by myself. I felt that this was only a partial project, but it was certainly a lot better than the alternative, which was abandonment. So we estimated this cost, we estimated the cost of this design at $398 million in dollars of the day, and I went to Cleveland to present it. Now the economics of the project were driven by potential cost reductions. We believed that over 1,000 jobs could be eliminated from the reduction of the truck haul in the pit by putting a primary crusher right in the pit, mm-hmm. By building the modern crushing and grinding equipment into the Copperton plant to replace the much smaller units in the Bonneville Magna and Arthur concentrators, and also by eliminating the 19-mile rail haul to the existing concentrators. We had a bit of a philosophical problem. You see, to calculate the economics of any project, you have to have a base case and for comparison with the economics of the plant that's going to be built. And the question was, what do we use as the base case? People in Cleveland, particularly Frank Mosier, insisted that we use a theoretical base case. In other words, what would be the economics if we pushed 77,000 tons a day through the existing concentrators? And then you calculate the cost savings from doing this in the modernized plant, and it's these cost savings compared to the base case that give you the return on investment. Well, we thought this was a little tongue-in-cheek, because plain fact was that the existing concentrators just couldn't treat 77,000 tons a day anymore. Hmm. I mean, our experiences in the winters of 83, 84, 84, 85 showed that it couldn't be done. Hmm. And some of us thought that it would have been much easier just to come out up front and say, look, we've pretty much reached the end of the road in trying to continue operating the way we are. This just has to be done, or you abandon the project. And we figured out the economics of abandoning Bingham Canyon. We figured that abandonment would yield substantial tax benefits, offset by the need to immediately address reclamation. Mm-hmm. And this was attractive to, number of the people in Cleveland. Anyway.
So that was actually openly considered.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, at some relatively stormy meetings at which mm-hmm. the BP people, the 53% shareholders in Standard Oil, very actively participated. Mm-hmm. Well, it finally came to pass in late 1985 in the in December of 1985, we made a presentation, a final presentation, and believe you me, there had been numerous others at lower levels. Made a final presentation to the BP board in London, and the modernization project was approved in the form that I have talked about.
This is the 398 million level?
Yeah. With just crushing and grinding at mm-hmm. Bonneville, not flotation. Mm-hmm. Well.
At Bonneville?
No, at Copperton.
At Copperton.
Yeah. Did I say Bonneville?
Yes.
I'm
yes.
sorry. My mistake.
The in-pit crushing and the...
In-pit crushing
and improving.
Conveying to the crushing and grinding plant at Copperton, a distance of 5 miles, and then the ore in slurried form transported in a pipeline to the supposedly beefed up flotation facilities, filtering and flotation mm-hmm. facilities at Magna and Arthur to supply the existing smelter.
Okay.
That was the concept. One thing that had helped the Standard and Standard Oil and BP people view the project in a more favorable light was that the Utah State legislature had agreed to give us tax concessions after an extensive lobbying campaign on our part. And Governor Bangeter was still the Speaker of the House at that time, but it was largely his understanding of our need and his leadership that caused the legislature to approve relief of sales and use tax for the equipment and supplies to be used in the modernization project. I believe that was a savings of the order of 20, perhaps $30 million for us. I may be wrong on that number, but that's my recollection. And it was this positive attitude on the part of the authorities here that made a substantial impression on the Standard Oil and BP boards. Detailed engineering on the project then began, and we found that when we first went out for cost estimates, that the construction industry in the United States was virtually dead, at least related to mining projects. And we were very pleasantly surprised by the quotes that we got for some of the 70 odd packages that we'd cut the project up into for bidding purposes. So we soon came to the realization that the estimate of $398 million for the scope as defined could be substantially cut. We also found that beefing up the flotation facilities at Magna and Arthur would be much more costly than we had anticipated. So the thought occurred to us that with the higher cost of providing for flotation at Magna and Arthur and the generally lower costs of the project components as indicated by these early bids, there might be an opportunity to modify the scope to bring the flotation to Copperton. We recognized that this entailed considerable danger because we sensed that Mr. Moser and his associates would favor taking the cost savings from the lower construction costs and perhaps diverting them to other uses and staying with the original design. About that time, the change in management in Cleveland took place whereby Robert Horton, whom I've already alluded to, took over as chairman of Standard Oil. He carried out a reorganization as a result of which Colin Webster, another former BP executive, became at least substantially responsible for Kennecott operations. I think the transfer of responsibilities from Frank Moser to him hadn't been formally approved, but we found ourselves having a dialogue, at least, with Colin Webster. We talked to him frankly, and showed him the logic of combining flotation with crushing and grinding at Copperton within the overall expenditure approval already obtained, and he indicated that he would try and win support for that concept in Cleveland and in London, and he went to bat for us.
So we found that we made a revised
cost estimate with this change of scope,
and
came up with a
project
costing $394 million.
For a
complete concentrator
at Copperton. And
after
again some rather contentious meetings, the Standard Oil Board approved this change in
December of 1986. A year after the original approval.
So you got what you wanted, and it was even less.
Slightly less than than the original, yeah. We could just foresee all kinds of difficulties in operating a concentrator divided into two sites. And we just didn't have the confidence that no matter what we did at Magna and Arthur, that the whole concentrate stream from this new crushing and grinding plant could be adequately handled, adequately processed. Detailed design and construction of the concentrator then went ahead with Bechtel as the engineering contractors and Stearns Rogers as the contract managers. again under the close supervision of Raman Rao and his team, Al Nuttall was a project manager on that job.
Nuttall?
N-U-T-T-A-L. Construction was favored by exceptionally mild weather in 86 and 87, in the 86 and 87 winters, and the project was completed ahead of schedule and well under the estimates in October of 1988.
Too much acclaim.
Yeah, well, it actually, by October 88, it actually had achieved the targeted throughput rate.
Mm-hmm.
And the throughput was subsequently enhanced so that by 1991 we were milling at Koppen at the rate of 86,000 tons a day.
Fantastic achievement.
Well,
possible abandonment to 80 plus thousand tons a day in a few years.
Yeah. Now, one thing that had happened before the completion of the project was the takeover by BP of the rest of the remainder of Standard Oil. And we had an opening ceremony in September of 1988 at the project site, just outside the completed concentrator. It was attended by BP and Standard Oil management. It had been raining